I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. In this edition of the show, you're going to hear three stories about math. Temple University math professor John Allen Paulos will tell us about his life in numbers, which he wrote about in his memoir, A Numerate Life. The new film Hidden Figures hits theaters across the country today. It's the story of the African-American female mathematicians who helped launch astronaut John Glenn into space. I talked with Margot Lee Shetterly, who wrote the book that inspired the movie. But first, we'll learn about the mathematical side of Benjamin Franklin with Paul Paslis, author of Benjamin Franklin's Numbers. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. Many of us, myself included, struggled with math in school. It was my worst subject. But we can still be inspired by those who have a facility for complex calculations. We begin the hour talking about the mathematical side of Benjamin Franklin. The renowned founding father is known for politics and science, but he also had an active interest in just plain numbers. We learned about this side of Franklin when we were joined by Villanova University math and statistics professor Paul Paslis, author of Benjamin Franklin's Numbers. Let's listen.
So am I the only one that doesn't know about Franklin's mathematical talents?
Well, hopefully with the publication of this book, every person on earth will know about Benjamin Franklin's mathematical talents. But this is something that I think has been elusive because although we prize interdisciplinary studies, academics tend to stay in our own houses. Mm-hmm. And so, I know a lot about math. Well, I know a lot about my type of math, but there are other types of math, or the sciences, the humanities, of which I know much less. And so if a historian is writing a biography of Benjamin Franklin, it's not going to be a comfortable place to be if it's not your primary field. If you see something that might be mathematical, it's hard to find a good way to include that. And also, biographers read other biographers. And so once you have a reputation for being a certain way, it's something that's difficult to shake. Hmm.
Did Franklin think of himself as a mathematician the way he might have thought of himself as an inventor, founding father, politician?
Well, I don't think that he thought of himself as a mathematician. In fact, I think he was intelligent enough to be aware of the great changes that were going on in that time, like the invention of calculus, to be aware of his ignorance, to be smart enough to know what he didn't know. On the other hand, if we extend the definition of mathematician to mean a person who thinks mathematically, right, or who can think quantitatively or can deal well with numbers in many different situations, then in that sense he was a mathematician.
Well, you talk about his inner mathematician his inner mathematician. I guess the idea that you might not call yourself that, but in a sense you think mathematically. You're a problem solver.
Yeah, he brought quantitative methods to areas where no one had done that before. So, for example, decision-making. He came up with a way of weighting the pros and cons in making a decision using numbers and matching them up and trying to have the negatives and positives cancel each other. This is something that's done today. The same sort of calculation is in calculating what we call expected values and probability or utility theory and mm-hmm. economics. And all of that was presaged by Franklin with very simple ideas. He also gave mathematical arguments against slavery. He gave a mathematical argument against war. When he invented daylight savings time, it was entirely a mathematical argument, very simple arithmetic, but it was an idea no one had before.
But I'm thinking, 300 years ago, what were people learning about mathematics, and what was known about mathematics at the time?
Well, it depends on which people we're talking about. Certainly, calculus had been invented, and there had been a lot of people before Newton and Leibniz who had done what we call calculus, but they were the ones who put it all together. But there were only a few popularizations out there, and it's very hard to, if you didn't know Latin, that's already a problem. And then you try to read Newton, and it's calculus, and it's in Latin, which is like, those nightmares that students have. It's the final exam.
Still
I'm showing up.
Them.
I'm in my pajamas, and I'm late. This would probably be like that. You get to the final exam. It's on calculus, and it's in Latin. So there were people who were mathematicians who were aware of these things, but most scientists were not. In Philadelphia itself, I profiled, four mathematicians, if we stretch the definition and include Franklin. And those were the only significant ones that I could find anything about. When you read in the Pennsylvania Gazette advertisements for mathematics tutors, it's always the same two guys. When you read who became the first professor at the University of Pennsylvania, it's one of those guys. When you read who wrote the almanacs and so on. So it was for calculus, there was a very limited audience. On the other hand, there was a lot of popular interest in astronomy. And so to truly understand mechanics, celestial mechanics, astronomy, you really would need to know calculus. But there weren't many people that were at that level, not here. According to the almanacs, if you base it on what Franklin wrote in the almanacs, it seems like people had more of a working knowledge of mathematics for things like accounting. Over and over again, he emphasizes the importance of accounting.
For practical reasons, obviously.
Yeah, he tells a neat story in, I think it's in the autobiography, but similar stories elsewhere about how women in particular can profit from learning accounts, merchants' accounts, he calls it, bookkeeping. And the example that he gives is that he had a journeyman printer who worked for him who went to South Carolina and set up shop, and Franklin bankrolled the new print shop. And the printer, whose name eludes me, he died, and his widow was left to run the business. She was born in Holland, and in Holland, according to Franklin, women did learn accounts. And so she was able to – he said she sent him reports about the business that were superior to what her husband had sent. And he said, for this reason, he thinks that women should learn accounting. It's very forward-thinking, like much of his writing. But when the Academy was founded, the Academy that became the University of Pennsylvania, he pushes geometry, arithmetic, logic, and many other subjects, but accounts. He's very interested in that. And he's a businessman. And so that's very important to him.
Well, and there seemed to be a playful side to him as well. And this gets us to these magic squares and circles that have an interesting history. But describe for our listeners, you're going to have to do this on the radio, what it is that we're talking about. And I have to say that they look like the great-great-grandfather of Sudoku.
And they are. They are the great-grandfather of Sudoku. So that Sudoku is a grid with numbers in it. And you fill it in so that you never get the same numbers in a row going across or a column going down and etc. If you
and
do
Sudoku,
you know
well.
I'm talking about. So Magic Square looks like that. It's a grid filled with numbers, but you don't repeat any of the numbers. And I guess the essential aspect of Sudoku that comes to play here is if you complete a Sudoku puzzle and then you add up the numbers in the top row, in there somewhere is 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and so on up to 9, you'll get 45 as the answer. If you go to the second row and add up the numbers, you get 45 as the answer. Every row going across or vertically, every column going down, they always add up to 45. Well, that's really the definition of a magic square. You have a grid with numbers, and you fill them in some clever way so that when you add them across or down, you always get the same sum. Now, Franklin didn't invent the magic square, but he took it to, I think, new heights. He took it farther than anyone had before him. We are almost certain that they originated in China. There's some debate as to whether they originated 1,500 years ago or 4,400 years ago.
But in Franklin's time, this was just done for sort of pleasure for what you might do in your leisure time, noodling with some of these magic squares?
Yeah, with one exception, which was that a couple of people had tried to use them for codes. Franklin didn't. He did use mathematical code, but not that particular one. But some of the alchemists had tried to use a 4x4 magic square. It was really just a way of having a list of numbers that was easily remembered. The key, you could remember it. You wouldn't have to write it down.
Right.
And but pretty much there was no application. Franklin has this reputation for only caring about applications, which really isn't deserved. Sometimes you need to look beyond his words and see a lot of the things that he did. When he investigated electricity, he certainly didn't know what would come of it. You know,
he was just curious. Right?
Yeah, he was. He had an incurable curiosity. He was he was at the not the first, but the second exhibition of the lighter-than-aircraft, the Montgolfier Brothers balloon, when he was in France in the 1780s. And someone in the crowd who was watching, who was next to him, said, "Well, that's nice, but of what use is it?" And Franklin said, "Well, of what use is a newborn baby?" And that was how he looked at, I think, all of his discoveries. Use was nice, but it might be so remote that that wasn't really the point of your investigations.
But these magic squares, I mean, they had no actual practical application except for maybe sort of mental gymnastics to keep to keep your brain nimble.
Mm-hmm. And he did recognize that. He said, well, that it may be that the arithmetic skills that you build by working on magic squares will be of use at other times. And in that way, there's a whole field called recreational mathematics where there are things that we claim aren't really useful. They just build your mind. But it turns out that all mathematics is useful somewhere.
It's good that way. And he kind of, not necessarily improved on the magic squares, but I guess added new elements mm-hmm. and complications.
Yeah, he was able to, I think of it as if magic square is like a flag. You color the top row red, the second row blue, the third, and so you get stripes, and you can add across the stripes or down the stripes. Well, he came up with these weird zigzaggy shapes that he fit into. His most famous grid, which was 8x8, there were, I think, 250 different patterns lurking in there.
Really?
Tic-tac-toe shapes and zigzags and shapes that were like shaped like a V, and you make a quick right turn, or you only count the corners, and so forth. And it was just remarkable. And he was aware of most of them. Some of them he didn't describe, but we think that he knew about them, or they wouldn't be there.
Well, there's some interesting correspondence with others, I guess, also interested in these magic squares, mm-hmm. and correspondence back and forth about doing them or making them.
Yeah, his most important correspondent in England early on was Peter Collinson, who was a scientist who eventually published Franklin's experiments in electricity, and that's what led to his fame and awards and so forth. And some people say that's what led to his success as a diplomat in France. So the magic squares that he sent to Peter Collinson may have been just one of the items on the menu that impressed him. I like to say that they played a small part in the forming of the Republic.
He also wrote an essay with a lovely title. This was back in 1751, Observations Concerning the Increase of Mankind and the Peopling of Countries, which I guess is another way of talking about demographics. I don't know how much of a science demographics was at that point.
I don't know of anyone before him who wrote as detailed a document as that. The Observations on the Increase of Mankind, that was written in 1751, he made predictions about the growth of the population in the colonies, and he talks about what we call today exponential growth. He doesn't refer to it as exponential growth, but he makes it plain that he believes that populations double in a constant amount of time. That is, in a particular country, perhaps it takes 20 years for the population to double, then 20 years to double again, 20 years to double again. And it doesn't grow at an arithmetic, a slow rate, where you're growing by, let's say, 100 people a year and it stays at 100. The number of people that get added each year goes up and up and up. And this is something that certainly was used by Thomas Malthus in the next century. And in fact, in the second edition of Malthus' famous book, he explicitly cites Franklin as an influence on him.
That's interesting.
Where he talks about, the food grows at this rate and we grow at this rate and uh-oh. Now, the truth is much subtler than that because we are still here. But this idea of exponential growth, it is described just in passing in that document. But I found, maybe a half dozen other places in his writings where he explicitly talks about doubling time in a way that makes it clear he understands exponential growth. And it seemed like in this article he was working without actual numbers, so he's been accused of being lucky in that he made correct predictions about how quickly the population of the colonies would grow. He says something like it'll be between 20 and 25 years, and I think it was 23 years was the doubling time over the next few decades. But it turns out that he did do the real work. It just wasn't in that document because he wanted people to read it, so he left the numbers out. Around the same time in one of his almanacs and around the same time in another set of writings, he gives population statistics for many of the colonies, for cities in the colonies where the complete data wasn't available. He does things that demographers do, like he extrapolated. He knew how many white men there were in a particular city. And in a city with a comparable composition of population, he knew the total population and the breakdown. So he was able to extrapolate from the number of white men to the number of people, slave and free men and women, adults and children, the total population. Now, that being said, even in his almanacs, he didn't really expect that the general reader would be able to understand something as deep as exponential growth. So when he gives a math problem where you're supposed to calculate how the population grows, he gives it the easy way. He says the population grows 64 people a year. How long before the population doubles and so on? And so he knows that we don't know as much as he does.
That was my 2007 conversation with Villanova University professor Paul Paslis, author of Benjamin Franklin's Numbers, An Unsung Mathematical Odyssey. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the African-American women whose math skills contributed to John Glenn's historic trip into space. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Math Edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
The new film Hidden Figures hits the theaters today. It's about the African-American women who were among the mathematicians behind John Glenn's 1962 historic orbit into space. They had to deal with racism and sexism inside and outside their world of work. Last month, we were joined by Margot Lee Shetterly, author of the book Hidden Figures, which was the inspiration for the new film. Let's take a listen. How did you hear of this story? And I should say you grew up in Hampton, Virginia. It sounds like you grew up in a world of scientists and mathematicians and engineers. But how did you hear of this story?
Well, basically, I heard of the story because I knew the women. So my dad, you know, as you mentioned, I grew up in Hampton, Virginia. My father, he's now retired, but he was a NASA Langley research scientist, an atmospheric scientist, and spent his entire career there at the NASA Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. And among the people that he knew and that he worked with were Katherine Johnson and Mary Jackson. You know, those women were people that, you know, my mother knew. And you know, a lot of these women who worked at NASA, I got to see them as just other people in the community, you know, neighbors, parents, friends' parents. But it was really about 6 years ago when my father was talking, my husband and I were visiting Hampton, my father was talking about some of the women and the work they had done, that this sort of transformed from being women that I knew into a story that I wanted to know.
Well, I do want to tell that story, but just to underscore how close everything was, your Sunday school teacher, Mrs. Land, was a NASA mathematician.
That's right. And she is somebody, you know, she was my Sunday school teacher when I was probably 9 or 10 years old. And but it wasn't, you know, until that 6 years ago as an adult going back home with my husband that the work that she had done and then, you know, the work that Katherine Johnson and these other women had done sort of began to take shape as this important thing that had happened in my hometown, but that I, you know, I really didn't know that much about.
Well, let's go back, because this really all begins during World War II. There are labor shortages, obviously, because of the war. And this was an agency that has we know now as NASA. That wasn't the name back then. Why were they, or how, and what were the reasons for opening the doors to a more diverse workforce?
Sure. So, yeah, as you mentioned, the story starts during World War II, you know, a time that transformed so many aspects of American life. And there were a couple of things happening there. So the predecessor agency to NASA, which was called the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, and during World War II, there was a shortage of labor, including male mathematicians, many of whom were sent off to the front to fight. At the same time, there was a skyrocketing demand for better, faster aircraft and thus aeronautical research to make those improved aircraft. So they really started employing women in general, more women in general, as mathematicians, the same as, you know, in the riveting factories that, you know, that we always think of, Rosie the Riveter and, you know, the aircraft plants. They also started looking to women to fill those jobs of mathematicians. But very specifically, a gentleman named A. Philip Randolph, he's a labor leader and civil rights leader who, at one time in American history, a lot of people knew, and I think fewer people know today, but he pressured then-President Roosevelt to open the defense industry, so the federal government, the civil service, you know, everyone who was involved with the war industry, opened those jobs to African Americans. They had previously been closed, and not just African Americans, Jewish people, Mexican people, a lot of people had been closed out of those jobs. Once those jobs were opened, you know, and remember, this was America coming out of the Depression, so
right.
These jobs were, you know, like rain on the desert. About 2 years after this executive order opening the federal government and those jobs to African Americans, the first 5 black women walked through the door at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory in Hampton, Virginia.
Well, in fact, one of those women was Dorothy Vaughan. I should say she's played by Octavia Spencer in the film. She's a college graduate. She's a math teacher. She supplements her income by doing laundry and by waitressing. She sees an ad in the newspaper and gets hired. Amazing.
Yeah, that's right. You know, a lot of these women, not just the black women, all of the women, they started their careers as math teachers. So back in those days, if you were a woman and you were good at math, the most likely outcome was that you would spend your days in a classroom teaching kids algebra and calculus. And so when World War II happened and these doors started opening, you know, this was a huge change for women of all backgrounds who were good at math. So once they would have just been math teachers, and all of a sudden it was possible to have a career as a professional mathematician or human computer, as they were called. You know, and a computer back then was just a job title for somebody who spent their days computing.
How were they received? I mean, I know the answer to this, but tell us how some of these early African-American mathematician women were received at this agency.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting situation because although the federal government had been ordered to integrate and open its doors to these black women, this installation was in Virginia, a Jim Crow state that still had segregation laws. So although these women were allowed to take these jobs and were doing the same work as their white counterparts, they were sequestered away in a separate office, you know, all black women in this office. They had to go to the colored bathrooms, and they had a colored computers table at the lunchroom. It really is kind of a curious circumstance of opening the doors, but, you know, making sure that all of these, you know, the segregation laws were absolutely enforced on those women the way it was in the rest of town and in the rest of the state.
You write about a woman, she's not featured, or at least she's not one of the stars of the film, a woman named Marion Mann, who, when she saw the colored computers sign in the lunchroom, she tears it down, and they put it back up, and then she tears it down again. Was she able to prevail over this?
Yeah, she was. You know, they put this little you know, paper sign on their table indicating that this is where these black women should sit. And every day she took the sign away and put it in her purse. And, you know, lo and behold, the next day there was another sign. So this went on for a while until one day the sign was gone. And, you know, I think that it's a good indication both of the kind of quotidian and really banal nature, ridiculous nature of this kind of discrimination, but also that, you know, the small victories can be as important as the large victories. You know, these small victories, scratching out just a little bit more room for dignity, you know, in that workplace of these women who are, you know, equal to the task that they're being asked to perform. Those small victories mean a lot, and they pave the way for greater victories in the future.
It's interesting, because reading your book, yes, it's about the integration of NASA, both racially and gender-wise, but it's also about what's happening in the world at that same time in the 50s and into the 60s, where you've got the civil rights movement and the protests against racism and segregation. It's an interesting parallel track that you write about.
Well, I really wanted to make sure that the events of the book both showed what was happening to the women, and to really sit on their shoulders and to see things as much as possible from their perspective, but also to connect it to the larger world. You know, the big world events have an impact on these women. Their lives are connected to Brown versus Board of Education, to the closing of the schools. You know, Virginia really took a very hard line and resisted for a very long time integrating its public schools well after the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And those, you know, that big picture life, those national events, they have an impact on everyday people. So I really wanted to make sure that that we got a view both of the, you know, this racism as these women experienced it every day, and also, you know, the impact of the larger society on their lives.
And here is Katherine Johnson receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom. This is November 24th, 2015, in the East Room of the White House. President Barack Obama giving her this Medal of Freedom. Here is what he says.
Growing up in West Virginia, Katherine Johnson counted everything. She counted steps. She counted dishes. She counted the distance to the church. By 10 years old, she was in high school. By 18, she had graduated from college with degrees in math and French. As an African-American woman, job options were limited, but she was eventually hired as one of several female mathematicians for the agency that would become NASA. Catherine calculated the flight path for America's first mission in space, and the path that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. She was even asked to double-check the computer's math on John Glenn's orbit around the Earth. So if you think your job is pressure-packed, hers meant that forgetting to carry the one might send somebody floating off into the solar system. In her 33 years at NASA, Catherine was a pioneer who broke the barriers of race and gender, showing generations of young people that everyone can excel in math and science and reach for the stars.
Margot, that's quite a story. Let's talk more about Katherine Johnson. What is she like? How old is she?
Well, she turned 98 years old this year, and she is, you know, obviously a brilliant mathematical person, but also tremendously charismatic, elegant, charming, very funny, and somebody who is and always has been very much in command of her own story.
She seems to almost, I don't know if she's modest or just minimize what she accomplished. One of the quotes is, well, I was just doing my job.
It is interesting. When you speak with her and interview her, and I've had the privilege of doing that, on several occasions, she does say that. And not just her, but, you know, the rest of the women, when you discuss, well, you know, were you aware at the time that you were making history? How did you feel about this? And more often than not, they'll say, well, I was just doing my job, you know. And I think we have to remember that, you know, a lot of these women came out of the World War II generation. They didn't necessarily spend a lot of time talking about their jobs or themselves or their achievements, you know. And certainly during that time, this work was considered women's work. It wasn't valued in the same way as the engineering that largely, you know, men did. Of course, in later years, women became engineers as well. And so I think, you know, I think it's really wonderful that with distance and with time, we can step back and we can value that work and see what an accomplishment it was and how they really were these aeronautical foot soldiers for aeronautics and for the space industry.
President Obama, you know, mentions John Glenn, and in your book, you quote John Glenn basically saying, get that girl to check the numbers, that girl meaning Katherine Johnson.
That's right. So the women of that time were all called girls. They referred to the men called them girls. They called each other girls. So Katherine Johnson happened to work for a group that was very closely affiliated with the trajectory of the spacecraft. That was their daily work. And she did all the math involved in, you know, calculating these equations, the orbital equations for John Glenn. In fact, her name is on a research report from 1951 laying out that math. When John Glenn was called upon, you know, it was his time to go into space, and computers were a relatively new thing at that time. They asked the girl, which was Katherine Johnson, to come in and double-check, basically do by hand what the computer had done electronically to make sure that both sets of calculations were the same.
Was she given any credit for that John Glenn space launch?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, people have been writing about Katherine Johnson in one way or another pretty much since that time. There's a great article from the Pittsburgh Courier, which is a black newspaper, from 1962, just after that flight, and really heralding her achievement. So, you know, those of us in Hampton Roads have known, you know, a little bit about what she's done for, you know, a long time. But again, she is modest and, you know, a member of the community as much as, you know, a NASA mathematician. But, you know, in recent years, it's been really wonderful to see her story get out to a broader audience. And through her story, to really uncover the stories of all of these other women who were doing excellent work, you know, in the earlier part of the 20th century.
Let me ask you about another person in this book who's also in the movie, and this is Mary Jackson, I should say. She's played by Janelle Monáe in the movie. She's really an engineer. What do we need to know about her?
Well, Mary Jackson is, her family was from Hampton. Her parents had gone to Hampton University. It's now called Hampton University, Hampton Institute, which is one of the earliest historically black colleges. She went to Hampton Institute as well. And she majored in math and physical sciences, you know, at a time when it was unusual for women of any background to sort of take the sciences and math as a major. And she is another person who worked as a teacher before getting a job there at the Langley Laboratory. She came in the 1950s, so a little bit later. She worked for Dorothy Vaughan, who was the black supervisor of the all-black computing group. And Mary, what she really wanted was to be an engineer. You know, she was a very good mathematician, but, you know, the engineers are the ones who are in charge of setting up the experiments, of designing the research, of making assignments to mathematicians. So Mary worked with an engineer, a white male engineer, who thought she was, you know, smart and suggested that, listen, you should apply for the engineering training program and you know, try to become an engineer. Now, get out of the computing thing. You should become an engineer. So that's what Mary did, you know, with the support of this man who really was a mentor and who later the two of them worked very well as a research team together. But what she had to do in order to become an engineer was first to take, you know, some advanced classes, differential equations, you know, theory of equations, things like that. And in order to do that, she had to get access to the white high school in Hampton. And even though these were classes sponsored by the Langley Laboratory, held after hours, she had to get this special dispensation just to walk through the door. But she did, you know, and Mary Jackson went on to become the first black female engineer at NASA. Mm-hmm. And one of, you know, perhaps the only, you know, certainly one of a tiny, tiny, tiny number in the entire country of black women in aerospace engineering.
You write at the end of the book that you could have called this, it's called Hidden Figures, you could have called it Unseen Figures. What's the difference?
Well, you know, the thing about it is these women, you know, the first white women started in the computing pool at Langley in 1935. The first black women started in 1943. From 1935 through 1980, hundreds of women were on the job, you know, doing this, working at one of the most exclusive scientific organizations in the world. And they were right there in Hampton, Virginia, you know, and people knew them. We knew them. We saw them as neighbors, you know, we saw them as Girl Scout leaders. But we never really saw or appreciated what they did. You know, it really took all of this time, I think, for us to revalue and revisit the work that they did and understand what a critical role they played in what we consider one of the greatest adventures of the American century.
That was my interview with Margot Lee Shetterly, author of the book Hidden Figures. A new film based on her book hits theaters today. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the mathematical life of Temple University mathematician John Allen Paulos. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're going to round out our math edition of the show by getting a more personal take on math. Temple University mathematician John Allen Paulos' memoir, A Numerate Life, details his early fascination with numbers, but goes beyond personal anecdotes. He describes how mathematical thinking can play unexpected roles in people's lives and minds. Let's take a listen to our conversation. You call this a quasi-memoir. So how are we supposed to read this book about you, that you've written about yourself?
With a grain of salt. I mean, there's some skepticism. I may try to be truthful, but people are taken in by their own narratives. And you look at a poll. I mean, it's election season. And if you find that the poll was had a sample size of 3 or 4, you'd say, what is that? That's not a poll. But yet we read a biography. It's written by, you know, either a friend of the protagonist or someone who's jealous or in some ways opposed to him, and you take that as gospel. I mean, there are all kinds of different approaches to life. You have 10 people. And imagine you're writing a biography or you're having a biography written about you. Would you want your best friend to write it, or would you want your worst enemy or somebody who's totally clueless or somebody who doesn't understand? I mean, you get all kinds of different accounts. And, I mean, even just in everyday life, forget biographies or memoirs or autobiographies. You know, I often hear, oh, so-and-so is this way and that way, and it's repeated over and over again. And then I meet so-and-so, and there's nothing like that.
But it's one thing when someone else is writing about somebody else.
Right.
But when you're writing about your own life, you have to rely on things like memory.
Like memory, like defensiveness.
Denial.
Denial. You want to be true to the narrative you constructed for yourself. In a way, writing a biography is a little bit like constructing a line or a curve of best fit, a notion that is common in statistics. You have a bunch of data points, and you want to construct a line or a curve of best fit, and you don't want too many points to be far off the plane, you know, and so you leave off extreme cases. And nevertheless, it's not going to be the total life. And, I mean, the extreme cases will be left off. I mean, people are very strange.
Yes, they are.
And, I mean, there's an old saying I like. There are two kinds of people in the world, the very strange ones and the ones you don't know very well.
You talk about, and it seems it's true today, you have had a lifelong passion for just plain old, for counting, for numbers.
Right.
From an early age, counting the number of cigarettes in someone's pack.
Right. And you might want to characterize me as a Rain Man, although I don't feel that way. But, yeah, as a little kid, I remember with my grubby little toddler fingers counting the cigarettes in my father's packs of cigarettes. And my first discovery was it was always 20, and I was quite proud of that. And it extended to my dubiousness about Santa Claus at a very young age, because how could he go to all these houses and stop and drink hot chocolate at all of them? And it just didn't make sense. I mean, it seems like kind of a pat memory for someone who's written a book entitled Innumeracy.
Yes.
But that was a conclusion I came to, which I hid from my parents. I didn't want they seemed to be very invested in Christmas, and I didn't want to disabuse them of their belief that I was.
Well, especially if you're a little boy doubting Santa Claus, I mean, maybe you wouldn't get presents that year, right?
No, I didn't fear that. I just didn't want to hurt their feelings. But
this is the way your mind was working even as, what, a toddler, like a 4 or 5-year-old?
To some extent. I had a kind of rough feel for numbers. There's one bit of horrible pedagogy I mentioned in the book that I've written about. And that is one day, I think I was in fifth grade, I mentioned in class, we were discussing sports, and I said that the Milwaukee Braves pitcher had allowed 5 runs and only got 1 man out, and that was an earned run average of 135. And the teacher, the math teacher, who was also a gym teacher, was, you know, very overbearing. He was kind of a martinet, and he says, sit down, you can't have an earned run average that high. And my voice was quavering, and I had a red face and sat down. But later in the year, the Milwaukee Journal published the list of statistics for everybody. This pitcher had never pitched again, and sure enough, it said he had a 135 batting average. So I went up and brought up the paper. This was a few months later, and he said, sit down. That can't be the case. But I knew I was right.
And he
knew I was right. That was what was important. And I realized that mathematics conveyed a certain power, that I could be small and shy, and he could be big and blustery and have this bulbous nose. But I was right and he was wrong. And I knew that. And it seems like that's a good kind of lesson to get across to students, even though it was horrible pedagogy. I realized that a little bit of math, a little bit of logic, and you could vanquish blowhards. And to some extent, that's more motivating than learning how to measure or estimate the height of a flagpole across the river.
Well, and it's interesting to take, as you say, the kind of certainty that you can be correct about something and then trying to apply that to people, to a memoir or to a biography, which, as you say, in many ways is about suspending belief. I mean, you have to, right. Especially if you're reading them, you know, is this true? Is it not true?
Right.
You want to believe it's true.
Right. In fact, I mean, you always hear about to read a story or watch a movie that seems a little outlandish, you have to suspend disbelief. But in science, statistics, you have to do the opposite. You have to suspend belief. People want to, biographers or just people in everyday life want to avoid false positives. I mean, there are false positives, false negatives. Some people are more sensitive to one or the other. But I think suspending belief so that you're not bamboozled is a useful trait. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And it also, because we've had people who've written biographies and memoirs on this show for years now, and there always is a little tiny part of me that says to myself, usually very quietly, what if this is true?
Yeah, no.
Did this really
I have that thought all the time.
And a couple of times I have to say I've gotten burned where it turns out that what someone wrote was not true, but you know, there's a vetting process, and you hope the fact checkers did their job.
Right.
But nonetheless, you have to give yourself over.
A lot of it can't be checked. I mean, what I did in the book overall is take vignettes from my life and then use them as jumping-off points to discuss the mathematical notions that are relevant to the telling of life stories of anyone, whether the notion be probability, coincidence, nonlinear dynamics. I mean, it sounds horrible, simple arithmetic. Even card tricks illustrate aspects of people's lives. So it goes back and forth between the personal and the mathematical, and I try to integrate them.
What do you?
it's a weird amalgam.
It is a weird amalgam, but it's interesting as well. In my family, we have this weird argument about coincidence and serendipity. Do you believe in serendipity?
Depends what you mean by it. I mean, the vast majority.
The things kind of align for a certain kind of unexplained reason?
Generally, no. I mean, sometimes, of course, things do align for reasons you don't understand, but the vast majority of coincidences are totally meaningless. I mean, one thing about coincidence that's important is you have to distinguish between the probability of some particular event or series of events. That's almost very tiny,
right.
Versus the probability of some general sort of event. There's some generically defined event, and usually the probability of that is pretty high. Like if you take you have a dial with the letters of the alphabet around the periphery, and you spin it 100 times and record the letters that they land on. So P, Q, L, A, whatever. The probability the word cat's going to appear somewhere in that 100-letter sequence
C-H-T-S.
Is small. Or dog, or chrysanthemum, of course, because of so many letters. But the probability of some at least three-letter word appearing is very high. And you can always generate that. You look at the first letters of the months, January, February, March, April, J, F, A. You have said July, August, September, October, November, the word Jason appears. Or the letters of the planets, and Mercury, Venus, Earth, and so on. You have Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, the word sun appears. Is that significant? No, of course not. But
but this is the way your mind works, right?
That's the way my mind works. It's funny. We were having dinner with a friend of ours who's an artist, and she read the book, and she really loved it. And she said what she liked about it is the sensibility it conveyed was so foreign to her that she found intriguing. Like she would never, you know, think about the things that I do in the way that I do. So it was kind of heartening because she's not a math person.
As I said in the intro, you popularized this word innumeracy, the idea of a numerical illiteracy, people not understanding probability and statistics and all that. I would include myself in that. Do you think you've made some progress helping people be more numerate?
It's hard to say because it's, there are certainly, if you're talking about schools, pockets of excellence throughout the country. Overall, I'm not so sure. There does seem to be a greater awareness of numbers. I often hear stories on the news that this is equivalent to this many that,
right.
And whatever. And that's kind of one of the things I did in the numeracy, and that's becoming more popular. And there's a lot of kind of mathematical writers that are more common now. The Upshot feature in the New York Times and so on looks at statistics 538. So as a society, I think at least the elite is much more numerate, much more conscious of the importance of numbers, the difference between million, billion, and trillion, and so on, is for a trivial example. But yet the vast majority of people are still innocent of such notions.
Well, do you blame schools, or is there
it's well,
people sort of a phobia about numbers or something?
Yeah, it does scare people. I mean, for example, probability. Most people's notions of probability, the vocabulary they use in discussing probability, is very impoverished. They think of maybe they know one in a million, 50-50, sure thing, and that's it. But I mean, probability isn't all that strange. I mean, it's a kind of refinement of everyday common sense. But nevertheless, most people don't refine their common sense, and there are all kinds of counterintuitive results, and people don't naturally think that way. And I mean, you know, Bayes' theorem, that is a way to improve your estimates of new things. But I mean, think of make up an imaginary scenario, prehistoric times. You hear a rustle in the bush,
right. You
run, even though it's unlikely to be a tiger. But the people who didn't run were eaten. So who survived? The people who jump at every coincidence, who jump at every tiny little provocation that doesn't mean anything. So our everyday kind of visceral attitudes are very different than the
so
ones
Darwin
that make sense.
So Darwin and innumeracy in a way?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And I mean, as Daniel Kahneman said, in Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, we have two kind of ways of thinking. One is intuitive, immediate, emotional, and then a second one that is more considered and abstract, but that kicks in very much later. But even with that, I use that playoff Bayes' theorem, revising your probabilities and thinking fast, thinking slow to discuss romantic crushes, for example. When you meet somebody, and sometimes there's just the barest interaction, and then you are crazy, you're smitten. And then gradually, as more information comes in, you revise your estimate of that person. Not necessarily, I mean, it becomes deeper. It doesn't necessarily become negative. But so, I mean, even the notion of a romantic crush can be looked at mathematically.
Have you thought about innumeracy in politics?
Yeah, of course. I think it's rampant. I mean, I'd like, it'd be interesting if during the debates the moderator would throw in, you know, not a calculation, but some kind of quasi-mathematical question, or even just a puzzle to see how people think, get them away from their canned responses, which are memorized and come tripping off their tongue. Actually, I shouldn't be all that superior about that, because a book tour and book promotion is a little bit like running a campaign.
Sure.
And a number of times I've been on television shows or whatever, they ask a question, and basically what I say is, I'm glad you asked me about X, but let me tell you about Y now. So it's a natural tendency to or association in a sense between campaigns and book promotional tours. But I think politics and numeracy are important links between the two. And
well, going back to, was it to the year 2000, this was Al Gore v. George W. Bush. It all came down to Florida, to a couple of counties in Florida.
Right.
The design of these ballots, the hagging chads, and you got yourself semi-involved in all of this.
Yeah. There were 6 million ballots cast, and the difference between them, official difference, was a couple of hundred. I mean, if you flip a coin 6 million times, you'd have a greater difference between the number of heads and tails. And there was, as you say, hanging ballots, misplaced ballots, military ballots, butterfly ballots. And I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times saying that the electoral apparatus in Florida was much too gross to measure the fine differences, whatever they were, between Bush and Gore. It was a little bit like measuring bacteria with a yardstick. You can't use such a gross apparatus to. And then I went on, and I said it was essentially a tie. There's no fact of the matter. And the recount was going on in Florida, which would determine the election. Gore had won more than 500,000 votes, had 500,000 more votes than Bush did nationwide. But everything hinged on Florida. And the recount was going on. The Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court stopped it because he said, I read this op-ed in the New York Times by mathematician John Allen Paulos, and he said there's no fact of the matter. And, you know, it's like measuring bacteria with a yardstick. And
right.
So he quoted me extensively, and then he said, because of that, I'm stopping it because if we continue the recount, it'll just we'll have more vituperation, more backbiting, more negativity, divisiveness. So he stopped it.
That was my conversation with Temple University mathematician John Allen Paulos. His memoir is A Numerate Life. A mathematician explores the vagueness of life, his own, and probably yours. And that wraps up the math edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Elizabeth Fiedler, Trinae Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.